Good afternoon. No? Good morning. Almost lunchtime, yes. I'm very pleased to be here. And today what I'm really talking about are factors associated with depressive symptoms among urban low-income African-American mothers of children with asthma. And I have nothing to disclose. What I'd like to do is today is to really describe the factors associated with depressive symptoms in urban mothers of children with asthma, to discuss the contextual factors in predicting depressive symptoms, and then finally to discuss implications for public health nursing. What we know is that depression is one of the most prevalent psychiatric illnesses and is common in women of childbearing age. We know this going back to the National Comorbidity Study, which we know about 4% of individuals will report in terms of depression in the past month. And then if we look at lifetime prevalence, that goes up to 17%, but 21% really for women. We also know that there's a relationship of adverse life events and chronic stressors to psychological functioning that has been clearly identified. So those are life stressors in terms of life events, but it's also daily hassles. And then the chronic stressors are very important in this relationship. And then finally, we know that psychiatric symptoms are also common in caregivers of children with asthma. And sometimes the percentage of mothers reporting depressive symptoms with asthma has gone up to about, by Bartlett study, has gone up to 47%. And so why is that important? It's important from the perspective of, we also know that depression in mothers is also associated with asthma attacks, ED visits, and hospitalizations. So what my purpose here is really to look then at the risk factors and the contextual factors beyond just individual factors. And so what we know, when you look at the literature in terms of looking at asthma, we know that there are neighborhood factors that are associated with asthma. And they certainly are related to socioeconomic disadvantage, housing situations leading to toxicants, and then overall exposure to stress is an aspect. We also know that studies have really looked in terms of looking at collective efficacy being somewhat of hopefully a buffering factor in terms of what's happening within a community. The other factor that has really been studied quite a bit in terms of relationship to asthma is violence. And so exposure to community violence is one aspect that I wanted to look at here. So in terms of urban concerns then, so that's with the asthma piece that I just described. But obviously what I'm talking about here is really looking at depressive symptoms. And so we know that there's an increasing role, an interest in the role of the urban environment in terms of predicting mental health. There is this relationship in terms of violence, and then this social cohesion and social control being important as well. So what I would like to present today is a prospective randomized controlled trial. This is actually a secondary data analysis from a randomized controlled trial that was really focused in on asthma communication and improving asthma communication. And the PI was Dr. Arlene Butts, and we've been a team in terms of this for a number of years in terms of two different asthma-funded studies. This analysis is really, I'm using the six-month data. And so it's on 300. It's based on the 300 caregivers of underserved children with asthma, ages 3 to 10. It was conducted in September of 2008 to January 2010. And caregivers were done face-to-face interviews, telephone interviews were asked, demographic questions, perceptions of asthma control and stress, life stresses, social control, social cohesion, and depressive symptoms. And as I said, we certainly have baseline data, we have six-month data and 12-month data, but I am presenting just at this point in time in terms of the six-month data. This is a model that I am using in terms of this particular analysis, and it's really conveying the fact that we were interested in looking at individual factors, and in this case, we know that because of the asthma connection to the study, looking at asthma, as perceptions of asthma stress from the mothers, as well as the medical history of the mom as well. So those are the individual factors. And then to extend it a little bit further in terms of knowing that the home is important as well. So the home in terms of the stressors that are connected with living in often very, very difficult situations in the urban city. And then finally, at the community level, we wanted to extend it in terms of looking at this experience of responding positively to the experience of community violence, and then to look in at the possible buffering effect, if there was one, or even just the relationship of social control and social cohesion. So in terms of eligibility for this study, the children had to be ages 3 to 10. They had to be diagnosed with asthma, and that was persistent asthma based on national guidelines, and which was a controller medication used during the prior 6 months and two or more ED visits or one hospitalization during the prior 12 months of the ED visit. So they were really picked up in terms of the screening, having attended two EDs in our area. And so that's how we really got them. This analysis, I'm focusing just on mothers, just so I could keep the gender aspect just to be moms in this case. This gives you some idea in terms of what it takes to get this number. It's pretty amazing over this time period. So the number of patients that were screened was 1,630, and you can work your way on down in terms of looking at eligibility or not being eligible, and then those who actually enrolled, and so we came down to 300 really at the end of the study. So it takes a lot. So I'd like to now just really basically describe the measures. Perceptions of, this was a question in terms of perception of the mother in terms of being, whether there was the child was believed to be well controlled. And this was just really a yes and no. And then the other aspect of asthma control was really to look at and categorize children in terms of how well controlled they were. And this is really based on the asthma guidelines, well controlled, not well controlled. It's asthma guidelines in terms of night symptoms, day symptoms, whether they're on a rescue medication, a few other things as well. The measure of stress was, in terms of how we got at stress, was a modified crisis, which is a 55-item assessment, really looking at the experiences of these particular stresses in the past 6 months. And what we used for this in terms of getting at the individual factors were the medical issues pertaining to self and the medical issues for family or friends, and then the home issues, and then the one question I used just in terms of community violence. We also used a visual analog scale based on 1 to 10 in terms of 10 being really high stress, asking them, the moms, their perceptions of their experiences of daily stress, but also daily asthma stress connected with having a child with asthma. The neighborhood conditions was what we used were neighborhood cohesion, which consists of 5 questions, which I'll show you in a minute, social control, and then this community stressor question as well. For the social cohesion, these are 5 questions that come from work by Sampson et al., and they really are getting at the amount of trust within a community. And you can see that it's based on a 5-point Likert scale, 1 being strongly agree to 5 being strongly disagree. So keep in mind, 5 is strongly disagree. So the higher you go, the more strongly you disagree with this, the alpha, Kronbach's alpha. And then social control was really in terms of, you know, how much social control is there within this particular neighborhood amongst themselves. The depressive symptoms was measured by the CESD, which is based on frequency of symptoms within the past week. The threshold of 16 was used. 16 or greater was high depressive symptoms with a Kronbach's alpha of 0.92. So I'd like to now report just in terms of some descriptive statistics, then look at the bivariate relationships, and then I'm going to present 3 different models in terms of building to a final model to look at the contextual factors for this. So this gives you an idea, certainly, that our sample was primarily African American. The mean age of the mom was 31, and you can see the rest, relatively poor community. And I have the statistics on them. It was 59% male children, I think, is what we were at. Employment is 55%. this gives you an idea in terms of where did the children fall in terms of their being under control. So a large percentage, 61% really fell within the poorly controlled area. This was not related, this particular variable was not related to the CESD. And this gives you an idea, finally, of the depressive symptoms in the mom. So about 30% of the mothers were high depressive symptoms, greater than 15. These were now the individual factors that we looked at. And these first two are really related to the mother's health. So you can see that 12% of the mothers were ill or had a flare-up with a chronic illness, and 10% were actually admitted to the hospital. And then you can see the percentage, the large percentage of children who had become ill or had a flare-up as well. And then in addition, then you can look at the bivariate relationships. It's pretty clear here that the relationships to depressive symptoms are related to the mom's health in this particular case and not so much to the children's, which sometimes may be a little surprising. In terms of perception of asthma control, this was significantly less control is positively related to depressive symptoms in the mothers in this case. And then once you look at the home factors, some of the individual factors that we looked at were someone moved into the home, someone moved out, rats, mites, and insects in the home, and then trouble with the landlord. And again, you can look at the relationships here, but someone moving into the home was related to depression, and the rats, mites, insects, and the trouble with the landlord. And then in terms of the particular scales that we use in terms of the visual analog for looking at life stress as well as the asthma stress, and then the social cohesion and social control were scales. And there you can see the means in terms of those, but the correlations to the CESD with all of them were correlated, but life stress was obviously a little bit stronger. And then finally the demographic bivariate relationships and these and seeing violence in the community, all significantly related. So from there, in terms of looking at the regression model, so this is regressing the depressive symptoms on these particular variables that we entered into the first model. And these were pretty much taking the demographic variables, which we need to control on, but then looking at those significant bivariate, pulling in those bivariates, positively bivariate variables into this model. And out of this, what we can see is that employment was related, the perception of asthma stress at this point, and then the mother becoming ill. And then going to the next step in terms of the now incorporating in the home variables in terms of what's happening and retaining those significant variables from the first particular model. Then what really happens is that daily stress becomes a more predictive factor here over the asthma stress. And asthma control is out at this point. But what is retained from this is someone moving into the home, rats, mice in the home, and then the education level, which is certainly an aspect of social economic status when we look at that as well. And then finally, the last model, which is now incorporating the community level factors, the community violence, as well as the social cohesion and the social control. And what we see is what we have in the final model is that education, daily stress, the rats, mice in the home, and seeing community violence were the factors that were associated with depressive symptoms. So with that, the conclusions would be that this really does certainly support a relationship of stressful daily events over concerns about health and illness. It supports the need to examine the influence of neighborhood level factors, in this case, seeing violence. And it advances, I think, our knowledge of social determinants of depressive symptoms in this vulnerable population. The limitations, of course, are the fact that it's a cross-sectional study, and we will go further since we have data over up to 12 months. We'll take baseline the next time, really, to look at this so we can truly say that these are predictors. And then we do have limited information on income, so I didn't really put that into the variable, but use those other proxy SES. I think this really, from an implication perspective, I think it supports the need to examine the influence of macro-level factors on psychiatric symptoms. And then to go a little bit further, we were trying to look at mechanisms. Social cohesion, social control do not come through in terms of understanding those particular mechanisms. But also it supports the need to assess for maternal depression in general pediatric care. And from a public health nursing perspective, to really consider that in terms of visiting homes, et cetera, or taking care of children and its impact on children. So those are my references. And I want to thank all of my team members, Dr. Arlene Butts, who is the PI on this, but we have a multitude of really a lot of team members in this whole process. Okay, thank you.
If I could ask Dr. Goshen to come to the podium too and maybe take questions for the rest of the time.
I probably need to leave soon.
Any questions for Dr. Kopp?
Yes.
Did you look at all about the mother's asthma? I know you looked at chronic illness as well as the depressive symptoms, but I just wondered if mothers with asthma, that they themselves had asthma, does that affect the child in looking at environment as well, in the rat and the
sure,
mice?
But, sure.
But the other piece of it is their stress level would flare their asthma, which then might serve
as a child. Yeah. No, we didn't. And the only, that one question that we have there is a illness or flare-up with a chronic illness. Now, you know, whether that's asthma or not, I don't know. Yeah. But it's a good point. Yeah. Yes.
So you believe public health nursing intervention can help reduce maybe the depression of these mothers?
I think it's important I think it's really important to be aware of the association and to do some assessment. I mean, the recommendation, even in terms of pediatricians doing some type of assessment as the children come in terms of moms, has certainly come up. Now, is that a too far of a thing to do? But from a public health nursing perspective, if we're making home visits, right, that's the big question, right? But if we are, to be aware of those factors. And then if you take it to the broader rung, I think, in terms of going out to the community and thinking in terms of what types of interventions can we do at that level, because that seems to be where we're heading more and more as well, in terms of the impact of all of these factors. I know it's hard, you know. Yeah.
Any other questions for Dr. Kopp?
Yeah.
One last question. You said it was data from a randomized controlled trial. What was the intervention?
The intervention was to have a more intense in-home intervention in terms of health, asthma education, and then going to the visit with the mom and the child in terms of with the medical provider.
Did you analyze the data in any way to see if that was immediately
moderated? No, we didn't. Yeah. In fact, we're just really at the stage now we have our data in now, and we're just beginning to look in terms of intervention control data, et cetera, victim control. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Questions for Dr. Gosch? I actually have one. Okay.
Don't go easy on me. Come on.
You stole my question.
It's, you know, we didn't do any cost effectiveness in this. And I think it becomes interesting when you look at misdemeanants who are going to do, like, short jail stints. Then I was actually I don't know if you were in the mental health court presentations yesterday, which is another, you know, diversion program. And some of the women in this study went through the mental health court. So for misdemeanants who aren't going to do a lot of stay, but they're going to get a lot of services in the community, the cost effectiveness might not work out for diversion. But in this case, these women were facing upstate prison time, which is extremely expensive. Supportive housing is extremely cheap. And you see with the relative the relatively minimal support services that were being integrated, even if we did include the additional supports that we recommended and more supports for the staff, I imagine, and of course I don't have the data to support this, that that it would be a slam dunk as far as cost effectiveness is concerned.
And do you think that it's not going to be the
So this body of literature, it can fit on the head of a pin. Like, I mean, seriously. No, there haven't been, following people up long-term has not happened. And you see, we had, such a small sample size. And we can say that even the woman who was discharged from the program and absconded and was found had never been caught for anything in the year and a half that she was out on the lam. So, and of all the women that we followed, most of whom have completed the program by now, none of them had repeated contact with the criminal justice system. And I want to say too. Oh, wow. I mean, that's an amazing question, and not a softball, definitely. That's a huge question. I have experience on Dr. Byrne and I's work with the prison nursery moms. We had a number of women who were allowed to remain with their child in prison in this very structured, beautiful program just to be sent to an ICE facility, separated from the child and deported, and just reunited with their child, like, on the tarmac. And deported. So certainly, as we've read, the Urban Institute has come out with all these really important reports that the immigration system, similar to the criminal justice system, just rips family apart. And as far as it relates to creating programs that would allow families to stay with their children pending deportation, I don't know. I think a lot of times maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong if you have significant experience in this area, that people don't want to identify that they have kids when they get, these women have to say that they have kids and, want to bring them in, that maybe that would be a big barrier from the side of the detainee in that case to implementation. So, yeah, that's a shadowy, terrible, terrible thing.
Any other questions?
And sort of me, I'm not sure if there's a question that anyone was about to say. I'm totally sure what it is, maybe that's part of the challenge. I guess I'm curious about the process of you as a researcher accessing your routes, and particularly the relationship, navigating the relationship between, having trust of people who are being criminalized by the system and the trust of those who are frustrated or formerly frustrated and the DA, and obviously being very close.
So setting up those firewalls, basically.
Yeah, and being able to, obviously you're able to build trust with your participants.
Yeah, so, as far as access to the program, Dr. Byrne had a long-standing relationship with the DA's office, and we presented with the two ADAs who were really the most instrumental in developing this program in 2007 at a conference on women in the criminal justice system. And so Dr. Byrne and I were presenting on the prison nursery work, and they were presenting on, hey, that sounds cool, but let's keep people out of the system. This is our idea. No one wants to do it. And they had been working on it for like 10 years until they got it funded and up and running. So we told them, hey, if you ever actually do this, call us up. Like, we want to be involved in the evaluation. And they did.
So as far as the setting up the firewalls piece, you know, we did have obviously the approval of the institutional approval to get into the setting, and Dr. Burns did all the interviews with the DAs and the coordination surrounding that, and then I was the one who was in the program and embedded in the program. So, you know, that was a good way, you know, to maintain those firewalls. We had that certificate of confidentiality, not that DA Hines would have ever, I mean, I could not imagine that having happened, but if it did happen to where someone wanted our data, we had federal protection for that not to be the case, and I think that that's always important. Most IRBs wouldn't make you get that, but we, you know, of course got that. So that was a number of ways that we maintained that. And then in the disseminating of the results, we tried to keep, so there was a deceptive breaches of confidentiality because there were so few women. So in telling the story, we told them in a, I hope, at least in a vague enough way where you couldn't pick out any one woman.
I think that question about the possibility of having a bridge continuation housing, which, you know, because we know so much about housing and how it affects women and their children, and with regard to domestic violence as well as criminal activity. And do they have an idea of how to bridge that into, you know, because I can imagine these people become very fake. Things are going really well for them, and then they have to move.
And then there's the apple cart again.
And everybody falls apart again.
So if the homelessness services provider that actually administers this program, and we strongly encourage them, we made this whole report, and strongly encourage them to seamlessly seg women from Drew House to their other supportive housing sites, that has yet to happen. But they're a very small organization. They're rapidly increasing in size, so they've gotten a number of recent grants that were quite substantial, and we're hoping that that would allow them to do that. And I don't know if anyone else here from New York says Dr. Brown and I, the housing environment in New York is unbelievable, and we, during the course of this study, lost a voucher program, which was specific to women in the child welfare system. You get a voucher. So actually being a child welfare in New York was good, kind of, because you got all the services that, you know, including housing, that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise, but you lost that, and so it became even more challenging. But we're certainly still in contact with the organization and working with them, and, you know, using this data to in the positive findings to try to get more funding to do just that.
But I want to thank you and Dr. Burns for working. I'll get teary. But with this population and with this issue, and I'm a boy, I would love to see this program replicated there. After working in women's prison, they only have like 300 women in prison. But it's heartburning because they're not a danger to anyone. But once they're in the system, because all of you know, I know I'm rich, but they can't get out. They don't reoffend, they simply violate. And then you keep going back in. And the housing in Hawaii, if you don't know, you pay $500,000 for a fallen gas house. We have Kapi'o Park Terrace, our public housing, that like what public housing used to be in the past. It's so bad. And so when you said housing was incredibly cheap, and I thought, but you're from New York and I'm from Hawaii, you know.
But comparatively.
Yeah. But that's, yeah. I don't know if I have my stats right, but $30,000 a year to keep someone incarcerated. It's probably more than that now. And yet, I would have that tip, like, wow, you just give somebody $30,000 a year and it's eliminated. So, I mean, I think this can be duplicated, and that's one of the reasons I'm so excited about our closing sessions. And David's here, too, and have joined Critical Resistance. You guys did a door and find out about that, too.
Get a cool newspaper.
I'm very much opposed to that as well, particularly African Americans. But I just want to thank you both for taking an interest in the population. Often, when we work with these populations, we ourselves are marginalized because there must be something wrong with us or being interested in these populations that we're less than. And they are, you know, the most vulnerable. And so I'm very much of it. thank you for this work, and I hope that you represent. And for Hawaii, we sent our women to places, we sent them away from islands they never went to, we raped and abused them, and separated from their families. And then you talk about tying that into an asthma across the systems, and we can help do them. So thank you for your work. I hope it stays a lifelong passion, even with you talking about your streak of gray, you're still a baby.
Oh, you're
work in this. If they say that your PhD is the question you want to spend the rest of your life answering.
I'm into it. I started out as a nurse in the juvenile justice system. So this has been a passion. It's weird. My family have an aunt who runs a reentry program in Fort Worth. My brother's a cop. But approaches it from a very social justice perspective, as much as you can in a small town in Texas. But I'm super passionate about it.
Any other questions?
I'm concerned about the younger women, like 18 to 20.
Or that's just the women that were in the program. It wasn't an eligibility criteria. You know, all the women that we interviewed were every single woman who's gone through this program at all. It's that small. We didn't include anyone.
Okay.
Yeah. But for the younger women, certainly the supports that are there, because they're relatively minimal, may not be sufficient for a woman who's dealing with criminal justice contact, probably a substance use disorder, mental illness, maybe,
and it seems like this is perfect for interprofessional education funding at Health Science University. I'm thinking of this at Loma Linda, you know, how we could, you know, get something like this going. It's the perfect venue for students to go work with families.
Yeah, I know that's a great point.
We have time for a few more questions.
I'm a doctoral student. And so, I don't know if you can reflect on your experience with schools as well, the role of ethnographic work in public health, beyond just the description of preliminary cases, and what you think it contributes and complements.
Well, I think, for me, initially with the descriptive piece, like you were saying, you're starting from somewhere. The program has served so few women. We can't go and apply models. It's just worthless, you know, to apply statistics to do, you know, quantitative work here. So just starting and providing a rich in-depth description as something grows. And then, you know, as things do grow, I think mixed methods are so important to provide context to the findings, especially in very vulnerable populations. And in our work, we're always having to communicate this work to the criminal justice system. And it's people, of course, there are criminologists whose methods are unbelievable. But the on the ground people don't have training generally in research. So to be able to tell this story in a systematic way is extremely compelling to people. And I think that's the true beauty of ethnography as it relates to public health, and that. Part of it is really telling the story in a valid way and getting it right, but part of it is compelling someone to actually do something about it. And numbers often don't do that. So that is that, like, support your question at all. But what do you think? You're focusing your doctoral work on it. What do you think is the value of that?
I I think it's best to merge them both, like
yeah,
this program without the cost information. You don't put the numbers in front of policymakers. You're going to have a hard time expanding something like this. The stories as well as the numbers together would create the best outcome.
We have to start somewhere, though. I feel like, yeah, you can't be premature also in your use of quantitative methods. Like it's chicken or the egg. Like you have to show something to get more money, but it's like, how can I really show something in a valid way without getting more money?
I just wanted to comment on one thing that we have actually spoken about at the Washington Plan, and I've thought about for the past 10 years. With ethnographic studies, because they do involve compelling personal anecdotal information, we as researchers have to be extremely vigilant about the media, which loves the story, but they don't necessarily have the context. Nor do they have the commitment that we have towards privacy. And so in the small group that could be identified in many ways, and we have in this case, this is an intriguing story that is of human interest to journalists. So journalists have gone out to journalists. The story was in the New York Times, it was in the Law Journal. I think we have to be very vigilant about access to the people that we're accessing in a different way, as an interactive partnership, which is different than a journalist accessing for any number of reasons, both well-intentioned and not necessarily so. So that would just be that, and that's when you go back to your question before about what's the relationship with the DA's office worrisome? Not at all. But it's a very long-term relationship that I developed 10 years ago when it was ongoing. There was trust here, when you mentioned trust was critical. But the media piece was troublesome, both in terms of us being careful about privacy issues, but also because it was through a media and a kind of not so much media, like a public relations twist for funding purposes that another partner put on this, that it was reporting as if it was cost effective to study and report that way. And then those numbers are picked up then by the lay press and reported again and again and again and quoted as truth. And so I just think that that's an issue that we just have to be mindful of, aware of. It's going to have media coverage of the things we're doing from the policy.
But I will say, in our defense, the media interest did not come. We didn't speak out for the media interest. It actually came from the DA's office. So it's not like we went and got these stories around, because that's kind of what it could potentially sound like.
Oh, no, I just didn't reply to it. It's just the opposite.
And if you did,
it cut you right out.
Yeah.
Back into that.
We have one last question.
Well, it's a comment. So, of course, I am William Walsh, who's the media, effectively, to bring attention to a worthy cause. So I don't know how we would read the privacy and all that, but I mean, it's something that can help, maybe get the word out, so to speak.
Most definitely. The first thing he'll say is, maybe go through 100,000 letters.
Yeah.
herself. She didn't have the post coming.
It's different to get a partner
to take some pictures and report where they're painful. I know. You're from Burger Park. She was afterwards and far away.
This was an excellent session, excellent presentation, excellent questions. Thank you all, and let's give a round of applause.